Good morning. So before the break, we were talking about hash tables. Hash tables were a way of implementing this abstract data type I call the set or map, where we have either a bunch of keys and we want to know which ones of them are contained in a list, but we don't care about order, we don't actually represent the order, or we have a bunch of keys and corresponding values and we want to quickly look up, given a key, what's the corresponding value, and also given a key, we want to change that value. And the idea of hash tables is we have this hash function we choose, and we make a table, an array of some size, and we just do array lookups, where we use the hash function to find the array index to use. And usually this means that all our operations are insert, remove, find for these maps and sets is just an array lookup, which means it's basically constant time. And we call these array entries buckets. Now, to make this actually work, of course, we have some wasted space because our hash table, we're probably not going to have it end up that all our keys and our hash function use every single array entry exactly the same amount of times. So typically to make this work, we have this extra table entries, which means when we look at our load factor, which I have written wrong on this. This is number of entries over table size, not that way. That's what I get for quickly writing up that slang, which is basically the average number of entries per in a table for each table entry that we want to have, that most of the entries have not one thing in them, because some of them are going to have multiple. And we have this target, and when we actually want to have this data structure be used in a generic way where we don't know the size in advance, we do this operation called rehash. We look at how big is our table versus how many entries do I have, and we have this target size, and we need to resize the table by recomputing all the hashes. We have to recompute all the hashes because, well, we place things based on a previous mod table size, and now that mod has changed. And there's no reason we would have stored the old hash values. We stored the keys because we need to compare them anyways to make sure, well, the hash matches. Is it really the same item? So we'll recompute all those entries. And we have this problem that we had to deal with, which is that, well, because our hash function is not going to be perfect, because we can't, anticipate all our keys in advance, that we're going to have some keys, which are different keys, and therefore we should be able to store simultaneously in our hash table, mapped to the same table entry. Either they'll have the exact same value of the hash function, or they'll have the same value after we take the mod of the table size. In either case, when we do our array lookup, we go to the same place, and we need to somehow be able to store both of the entries. So our first solution to this, and the simplest and the most flexible solution, is what we call chaining, which is that our buckets, and the reason we didn't just call them, keys, are actually linked lists. So we have a linked list there. We just search the whole linked list. Usually the linked list is one entry or zero entries, so that's really trivial, but sometimes it might end up being pretty long, and at least we can know how to search that and find what we're looking for. And yeah, it's inefficient when we do that, but the common case is that we have exactly one thing we're searching, and then we look at the next pointer, it's null, we're done. And we talked about a second solution that we finished on last time, which is something in a general category of solutions we're going to call open addressing. So here, we're going to have each of our table entries actually be either just a key or a key and a value. We're not going to have a list of entries there, which means that when we look in a table entry and we don't find what we're looking for, we're going to have to look elsewhere because it might be there, unless we found that there's nothing there at all. But if we find the wrong key, We're going to say, well, the key I'm looking for could still be in the table, and there's going to be some other place I look. And the simplest policy we talked about was this thing I'm going to call linear probing, where we choose where we start searching based on the hash function as usual. So if we have one entry, we're storing things in the exact same place. But rather than have this next pointer, we're just going to say our next item is the next entry in the table. We're just going to take that array index we computed, add one. If we go to the end of the table, we're going to wrap around. And that's where we're going to store things. So in this case, we're taking advantage of the fact that, well, because we've sized our table based on that load factor idea, we're going to have a bunch of empty entries. We're just going to use them to store these things which happen to map to the same array index naively. And we're going to be searching basically the same number of things, so it's not going to be significantly less efficient than we were doing chaining. And in fact, it's probably better as far as searching for items because, well, we have a much more compact way of representing the items. We're just incrementing an array index. We aren't having to search follow pointers. We don't have to update pointers when we insert items. So it's probably better. But this has a bit of a, disadvantage in some cases when our table gets kind of full or we have some bad luck. And that's that entries for different array indices get put together. So here I have two keys and their values get mixed together. So when we're searching for 25, we're going to need to go look at 13 in this case, then 38, even though that had a different hash function value. Whereas with chaining, you wouldn't have to search these entries which are not mapping to the same bucket. But because these happen to be next to each other and we just store it in the next available space, we do that. And also this obviously means that removing entries from this table and still being able to find other entries is a lot harder. Because if I went to remove 38 now, I need to do something special because I don't want to make it so I can't find 25 anymore. Because when I look for 25, I'm going to start at 13. If 38 is listed key equals none and I stop, well, I didn't find 25, and that's just wrong. Because 25 was inserted and not deleted. So this is a thing which happens sort of naturally with linear probing, this idea of going to the next entry, especially when our table gets pretty full. When our table is pretty empty, this is unlikely, but this is a thing which happens very commonly. So there's a generalization of this idea of open addressing, and in large part it's meant to address this sort of issue where we get these clumps of keys. So here we have this clump of keys, and this is going to only get worse. Because what's going to happen is, well, we have something which hashes to goes to index 4, that's going to add to this clump, and we have these natural clumps of keys with holes in between them that will end up occurring in our hash table, even when it's not extremely full. When our hash table is almost full, obviously things get really, really bad. But we can avoid that by having a target load factor that's pretty low. Like a common thing people might do is like half for this scheme. But another way of avoiding that is to not have things be consecutive, which hopefully keeps us from having these clumps of keys. So we can generalize this idea of open addressing and say that we're searching our initial bucket, and we have some function which we use to offset that search location. And first we supply that function 0, then to look for this next place we supply it 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And this gives us a list of places to look. In the case of the first scheme I showed you, linear programming, that function is just f of I equals I. So first we look at h of k plus 0, and h of k plus 1, h of k plus 2, and so on, until we get to the end of the table, then we wrap around. And so a simple thing we can do is we can have different ways of choosing that f. So one simple idea is that instead of choosing f of I equals I, we choose f of I equals I square. This is pretty easy to compute. And it means that we'll start jump further ahead in the table, so we'll get rid of these clumps. We're not gonna have clumps there. We're gonna skip a bunch forward, and hopefully we'll have less coincidences where we get these clumps that we're searching through, and we'll be able to fit more items without having our table be inefficient. Another common option is you might say, well, if I'm getting these things mapping to the same bucket, that probably means I chose a pretty poor hash function, and maybe I have some other way I can construct a hash function that's just systematically better for things that the other hash function is bad at. So I'm gonna have the second hash function, which I hope, you know, works in the cases where the other one doesn't. Maybe I don't use it as my first hash function because it's like a lot slower or something like that, but I'll use a second hash function to find it, find my location, and I'll just skip ahead however many entries that says to go. So let's look at, for example, quadratic probing. And I do not know why this slide doesn't display correctly. That should be like so. Okay, so in quadratic probing, we're gonna have some hash function, we have some index, which is a 10, and when we went to look at our next things, next places to look, we're not gonna have chaining. Instead, we're gonna look at plus 1 squared, plus 2 squared, plus 3 squared, and so on. So for example, when I insert 4, my hash function gives me 19 in this 10 entry table that goes to entry 9. So we just put it in index 9. Went to insert 27, goes to entry 8. After I take the hash, get 88, and then take that mod 10, or table size. And when I insert 37, did I actually do this wrong? Yes, I did. Huh. Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, apparently I can't square 2. And somehow didn't notice when I was constructing this example. Yes, so what this example is supposed to say is that we go to table 8, then we add 1, and then we were supposed to add 4, which 8 plus 4 mod 10 should have gotten us here. But we didn't do that, obviously. So because I know I need something to work later on, I'm just going to change this to 38 and this to 119. And that will go to 37. Which is probably what I meant to do. So this should be, close that out, and 30. Oh, wait, that won't go there. We'll take, subtract. Oh, sorry, we'll add. Yes, so that was meant to go to something that goes to 119. I can't actually do math in my head to make to figure out that value, but we'll assume that that worked out. So that was supposed to go, so I made a mistake constructing the slide. I thought that I, for some reason, added 2 instead of 4. So for what we're supposed to do when searching from 9, we search here, then we go 1, 2, 3, here. 1, 2, 3, 4 here. And that's the sort of pattern we search in. If we start at 9, if we start at 8, we would have searched here. We'll do a different color. We would have searched here, then here, and we would have stored it here. That's where, if it hashed to 118, that's where it should have been stored. And the reason I'm going to keep it there is because I want to show what happens in a more complex case of conflicts. I guess I'm just off by one everywhere. Yeah, that's probably exactly what I did. Yes, just totally off by one everywhere. Okay. Because that should be, yeah. But give him one. Wow, yeah, that's just basically off by one. So we'll skip that example. Oh, okay. So I did linear probing and called it quadratic probing. That's what I did. Okay. I'm sorry for messing that up. Oh, okay. And that's why I was confused. Okay. So I know what's going on here. So yeah. That is embarrassing. So the mistake I made is I mistitled this slide because I have the correct example here. Okay. So this is linear programming, and this is the clumps we were getting before. This is another example of getting those clumps. So I didn't do this incorrectly at all, but I explains why when I was trying to correct that I look right because I was looking at the wrong slide. Okay, so but we got these sort of search forwards and we got this clumps. So we're going to do the same pattern here. Start with the same sort of pattern here, but we're going to have something different go on. So we're going to insert, in this case, 4, go into that 9 slot. We're going to insert 27, goes into the 8 slot. So this is the same thing, thing we started with before. And then we're going to insert 14. And 14 wants to go here. And just like linear probing, the first thing we search is plus 1. So we end up in this slot. Then we went to insert 37. So the first place we search is going to be here. Well, that's already taken. Then the next place we search is plus 1, which is here, then plus 4. What I wanted to do just before. Whereas in our linear probing example, we ended up at slot 1 there. We had no gap. But because of quadratic programming, we have a gap. Quadratic probing, we have a gap, which avoids this clumping we were worried about before. Then we insert 22, that goes in slot 3. And, you know, in linear programming, we were worried about this creating another clump, but that's not going to happen so much here. So then we insert 34, which goes to slot 9. So for that, we end up doing a lot of searching. We look in here first, then we add 1, then we add 4, then we add 9, and then we finally add 16. So we had lots of conflicts because we just were very unlucky. But unlike with linear probing, this is not something which, because of what we have set up in this table, we expect to happen for any random value. But with linear probing, when we ended up with this example here, if we happen to choose anything in this sort of range, we're going to search through a lot of values to find a slot. And that's just going to make that problem worse. And you know, if we choose a random location, we have some possibility we'll end up in that sort of thing. With quadratic probing, you know, since we're searching these faraway locations that are sort of random, they're not really random, of course, but they're sort of random because we're taking mod this hopefully in a reality prime table size. In this case, it's not, just so I can easily take the mod in my head. We'll end up skipping around the table, and that won't be a big deal. Okay. And so our last technique was about double hashing. So with double hashing, we're just going to choose a second hash function. So in this case, we have our first hash function is the simplest possible one. That's a common thing you'll see with double hashing, is the reason to use double hashing is that you have a really fast hash function you really want to use, but you know that it's bad sometimes. And double hashing is kind of a way of mitigating that we can get away with using this bad hash function because we'll quickly switch to a good one, essentially. So then we have this second hash function. In this silly example, it's 7 minus k mod 7. I'm not sure if it's actually a good hash function, but the choice. So we insert 89, goes where we expect. We insert 18, we insert 58, and we want to put it in slot 8, but we can't put it there, so we compute our second hash function, 7 minus k mod 7, so 58 mod 7, 7 minus that. We add that to our index 8, wrapping around, and that ends up adding 5 and goes to that slot. We do the same with 49. It naturally hashes here, because our initial hash function has lots of conflicts, it turns out, which is not uncommon. We have our 69, and because we have this second hash function, which is different, even though we have three things in that first place is the same bucket, because we're using the second hash function, we actually don't search the place where 49 goes. Whereas previously, that's something we would have been doing. So in this case, this is the first place we end up looking. We compute this, we get plus 1. When we did it for 49, we got plus 7. And so we don't end up searching in the same places. We have one additional look operation because our second hash function usually is going to work out. At least that's the hope, if we've chosen it correctly. So this is sort of what we hope happens with double hashing, is that we use our first hash function. When it doesn't work, almost all the time, our second hash function finds an empty space to put the value. And of course, like with all these techniques, this is going to break down when our table gets very full. Even no matter how good our second hash function is, pretty much. So something which can happen with double hashing is that we can get what we'll call thrashing. So here I have two toy hash functions. I have this simple h of k equals k, our really, really fast hash function. And we have this second one. So let's first insert a bunch of values with no conflicts whatsoever. 10, 12, 14, 16, 18. Now let's try to insert 36. So initially, when we insert 36, we want to put it at index 6. Then we compute our second hash function, h2 of 36, and we get that this is 2. So we want to insert it at 8. And then we try 2 times that. So that's 0, then 2, then 4, then 6, then 8, 0, then 2, then 4, 6, and 8, and so on. And it ends up that we don't look at half the table. So even though we have a load factor of 1/2 here, and our table has plenty of empty entries, and even though we have this scheme to look for other places to put our value, because our second hash function happened to be 2, and our table size was 10, we ended up scanning only half the entries, and it happened that all of them were used. This is known as thrashing. So here, when we try to insert this, we're going to get can't fit. Our table is full, and we generally don't want this to happen. We want to, have a rehashing policy based on the typical case, not when we get really unlucky, usually. We might not do that. And we'd like to have some guarantee that this won't happen. So what's something we can do to make sure that this doesn't happen? Yes.
If you do the cron table size thing, it would prevent this?
Yes. So, the issue is that 2 and 10 are not relatively prime to each other. So the easiest solution is we choose a prime table size every time. And we'll come up with similar issues for some of our other schemes. So for I squared, we have this kind of problem. It's not as bad. We'll still search other entries. But for example, if we have a table size which is a multiple of 2, well, I squared for every even I is going to be a multiple of 2, and we'll end up using less of the entries of the table when we're doing a search to look for a lot of places for a value, and that's not so good. So this is a reason why when you're doing something like double hashing, you absolutely, definitely should use prime sizes. Like, you're in trouble if you don't. With chaining, it's obviously not so bad. With chaining, we're still gonna do the right thing, we're not gonna run out of space if we don't use a prime size. But you'll still often find that even without open addressing, that we're gonna use prime sizes. And the reason why, the biggest reason probably, is that this is more forgiving for not great hash functions. So for example, when we have our keys as integers, commonly we're gonna choose the hash function of just h of k equals k. Why are we gonna do that? Well, because if you give me integers and tell me I want to make a table mapping integers to values, I don't know what those integers mean. I can't really come up with a better hash function. Like, how do I know anything about whether your integers are just already evenly distributed when I take them out of value or not? I just don't know. And when you use, therefore, a library that provides a hash table, its default hash function's probably gonna be that one because, well, it's very fast and they don't have any reason to know that your integers aren't already relatively evenly distributed. Like, if they're just ID numbers that you assign 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they probably are. If there's something more meaningful, they probably aren't. And using a prime size makes that, that sort of guessing not so bad. Like, obviously, if our hash function was ideal, we wouldn't have to worry about this. But we're not gonna have ideal hash functions. And this happens with more than just even. So if you consider example that maybe our keys are naturally multiples of 10 for some reason, just because like humans choose numbers that are end with 0, then if our table size is a multiple of 5, we'll have the same kind of problem where we have more coincidences. And that's not something where we're choosing our table size to be a human value, just to be a multiple of 5. There's obviously a disadvantage with using prime sizes, which is that we have to take mod the table size. But that's hopefully not a very expensive calculation relative to the other things we're doing. Okay, so any questions about open addressing and sort of the normal mechanics of doing lookups in hash tables with these various schemes? Before I move on to a couple little nit topics about hash tables, and we talk about our next topic. Okay. So we talked about our probing techniques. So we had our linear probing, our quadratic probing, double hashing as alternatives to chaining. And one issue they have is that they make removal a lot trickier. So when we're removing from chaining, it's a linked list removal. We just search the linked list and figure out which next pointer to adjust to get rid of the item and do a delete. So essentially what you did in earlier homework, except we probably have a singly linked list instead of a doubly linked one, but not hard and definitely straightforward and not expensive. Like, it should be big O of n time, where n is the number of entries in the bucket. Because you just find the item and then you unlink it from the linked list. With open addressing, this is hard. And there's a bunch of options for handling it, and none of them are particularly satisfying. And the issue is we want to not disrupt searches. When we remove an item and open a dressing, you know, what I showed you before is that when we're searching for an item, either to place a new item or to look for where it might be, we look at our first location and then we look at our next location with linear probing. That's the next thing in the table. With quadratic probing, that's by 1, then 4, then 9. With double hashing, we compute that second hash function. But either we look in these second places, the third place, the fourth place, and when we don't find anything anymore, we say, well, it's not there. So if we just remove an entry, well, it might be on the list of things we search for even a different key. If not just a different key, a different, you know, initial hash bucket. And we'd have to like search the entire table to find out where that happened. That's, you know, really expensive, and we don't want our removal to be big O of N time, but that is a valid option. So one thing we can do is we can say, I think removes are really infrequent, I don't really care if they're fast, and we can just say we're going to rebuild the hash table every time we have a removal. We're going to just rehash everything. That works, it's correct, it's just super expensive. Now our removals are big O of N time. If we do N removals, that's big O of N squared time. You know, hopefully we aren't doing them very often. So another option that's correct and a lot less bad is that when we remove an item, we don't mark the table entry as empty, but we put in some placeholder value. We have something where instead of saying, like we did with our initial entry, we have this key equals none, we have some other value, which is key equals none, but don't stop searching. So this is placeholder value, which is, you know, this would be sort of none versus none, but keep going. You know, we have some none but keep going value, which would be different than none, and we have that in our table. And so removal would just be replacing the key we actually have with none but keep going. And eventually we want to rehash because we don't want our table to just be entirely none but keep going entries. So eventually we rehash. Another option is to just disallow deletion, and I believe this works in your lab. When you have to implement a hash table, you can just say, we're not going to allow deletion. That certainly solves the problem very well. So, any questions about removal from hash tables? Okay. So, that's everything I have on just normal hash tables. I apologize for fumbling with my linear / quadratic probing example earlier. And hopefully everything you need to know for the lab this week. So I'm gonna talk about one, yeah.
Do most real world hash tables use probing or chaining?
The question is, do most real world hash tables use probing or chaining? So hash tables which are provided by general purpose libraries, to my knowledge, usually use chaining. I haven't like done a survey, but it makes sense to use chaining in that case because of the removal handling is probably important. And often people have hash value keys which are pretty big. And so like the extra space for an X pointer is not a big deal. And the key might be a string and you need to dynamically allocate that anyways. So it's less bad, but I'm not actually sure what actually happens. In general, I haven't done a survey. Of this. My understanding is that when tuned correctly, open addressing is probably faster for most applications, especially if your keys are pretty small and easy to compare. But there are inconveniences, and removal is probably the most notable inconvenience with open addressing. So other questions? Yeah.
If there's a thrashing in our program, what does it add to
it? So the question is, what happens when you have thrashing? So this thrashing I showed, we would just keep searching, we keep incrementing I, and if we didn't write special code to handle it, we'd just have an infinite loop. We'd say, well, our load factor isn't too high, so we should have space. And we just keep going, we wouldn't find anything, and we'd just have an infinite loop. If you had something to handle it, presumably you'd say, wait a moment, we've searched a number of entries equal to the table size and haven't found anything, something's wrong. But you don't have code to handle it, it's just an infinite loop, and that's, you know, pretty bad. And I guess that could happen naively, like with linear probing. If you aren't like checking, do I need to rehash and resize my table? You do linear probing, you just go through the whole table, wrap around, keep going. You know, there's no entries that are free, your table's actually full. You know, that will happen. Usually it wouldn't, because with linear probing, what happens to performance is that, you know, if we talk about, if we have, this is load factor one, with linear probing, the performance looks something like this. As you get closer to the load factor one, where this is runtime, it goes like way, way up as you get close to load factor one, just because usually you end up searching the whole table when it gets almost full with linear probing. And so, you know, if you had the case where the table was full there, you probably noticed earlier that, why is my hash table really, really slow? Okay. So that's about hash tables. There's one other topic related to hashes I'd like to talk about, mostly because, it's on Florian's slides, but also because when you think of hashes, this is something which often comes up, and they're kind of different than the sort of hashes we've talked about before. And these are cryptographic hashes. So one example is SHA-256. There's some others, like MD5 is a classic example. And these are hash functions. So they take a string of bits. In the case of SHA-256, it takes any string of bits and outputs a hash value, which is a 256-bit number. So that's a lot bigger than the sort of hash functions we've talked about. And we'll see why in a second. And the cryptographic hashes are meant to have these security properties. So in addition to being good hash functions, which means that then you put in a value, get something that's kind of evenly distributed based on that value, obviously, if we have 256 bits of output and we have any size input, there's some values which have the same output, just like a real hash function. You have this big output, but they have these two security properties. And they're security properties, meaning that I, as someone who's trying to break things, can't do something. So they're properties that hold against an adversary, someone who's deliberately trying to make something happen. So these aren't properties that happen just naturally. So with our hash function, we're concerned about, given our keys, what's going to happen usually. With cryptographic hashes, we're worried about, given that we have someone who's constructing scenarios where bad things will happen, they're trying to make bad things happen, what could happen? And the two properties that are important, so one is something we're going to call collision resistance. And this intuitively is the same kind of thing we're looking for with our normal hash functions, which is that if we put in some random values, we're going to get things which hash to different values. We're not going to have two things which hash to the same thing. But we're caring about these as security properties. These are properties which have to hold even when someone is deliberately trying to make them not happen. So this means that it's very hard for a cryptographic hash to find any two keys such that the two hash values are the same. And this is why the output of these cryptographic hash functions, like SHA-256, is so big. 256 bits, that's huge. You know, previously we have, like, we hash an integer, we get a 32-bit integer. Because if not, well, here's a simple algorithm to find two keys with this, which have a collision. You just, you know, if you have a 32-bit output, you hash 2 to the 32 things. Yeah, that takes a while, but it's not that long. And you'll find something, because there's only so many possible outputs. With 256 bits of outputs, you need to hash 2 to the 256 things, and that's a huge number. You literally do not have time to do that, no matter how many machines you have. So an example application that takes advantage of this property is you want to verify the download of some file. So you're given some file, you know, in an untrusted way, but to verify it, you have this trusted information. Someone you trusted, in some way you trusted, gave you this small 256-bit value, which is the hash of that file. And your adversary supplied you with the file and wants to fool you into thinking that they gave you the genuine file, even though you have this hash. Well, because the adversary can't possibly find two files which collide, no matter how that file was constructed, you know that knowing that the hash matches is good enough. And that's the sort of thing cryptographic hashes are designed to let you do. And our normal hash functions don't have this property. So here's a normal hash function. How do I construct two strings for this hash function which have the same exact hash value? So here, we're just taking the characters of a string. We're multiply times 37, then add a character, multiply times 37, add a character, and so on, returning the total sum. Yeah?
Take the string and then switch the letters around. So you've got the same length, same letters.
So the question is, the argument is to just shuffle the letters around. So that would work if we didn't have this times 37. But yes, if I was just sum all the characters, that would be a way of doing it. Yeah.
Start with the number.
Yeah.
And then divide by 37 and pull out some number. Right? Then make that the last character. Divide by 37, pull out some random number, make it the last character. Divide by 37, pull out some number.
Okay. So your idea is that we can just take a value and can figure out, based on dividing by 37, what just we can choose something which hashes to that. Which gets to our next security property. But and so one simpler example is that if I just take add 37 to the last digit, last character, and subtract from the previous one, that's going to give the same value. But we can just manipulate it because this has this nice mathematical structure, and it's very easy actually to come up with two values which hash the same thing. And this is what our adversary is going to be doing. So we're worried about someone maliciously doing it. They're going to, you know, give us a pair of files with the same hash and have us think we downloaded one but actually get the other, because they can deliberately construct the files to have these properties. These aren't things which happen naturally. We don't naturally have strings where we have ASCII characters 37 apart and then we go down one in the previous character. Like, that doesn't happen in a normal string, but our adversary can certainly make sure that this happens. So the other property that cryptographic hash functions have is something called pre-image resistance. And one version of this is that if I give you a hash value, so what you were doing before, it's very hard to find any key that has that hash value. So, you know, obviously you can easily find a K and a V, you know, here, which are a pair because you choose a K and then you find the hash value, that's it. But if I just give you the hash value, you can't go backwards and find out what key I had. And usually collision resistance implies pre-image resistance. Usually it's easier to find collisions than it is to find pre-images. But this formally, this is not so clear. So this lets me have a message substitute for another. So we talked about verifying downloads as an application. So that takes advantage of, you know, being able to, you know, not have two files with the same hash that our adversary could construct for us, where one is like the normal executable and one's the malicious one. Another example is message authentication, I want to know message X really came from who, where I thought it was. And commonly to do this, you have this sort of magic math function where you take some, do some secret operation that we can verify says, you know, it really came from me. And but usually that operation only works on a very small amount of data, just because it's a very mathematically complex operation and not something we can do, say, on like a 1 megabyte email. But what you can do is you can use this a hash function to turn that 1 megabyte email into a small 256-bit value that's equivalent. And because we have pre-image resistance, we know that even if we give our adversary a copy of that 256 value, they can't possibly figure out what our email was about if we do this right, because they can't find the key which produced that value. So these are things you'll learn for real about if you take some security course. But mentioning them because you see hash, you know, hash functions, and you might wonder, why are people talking about this SHA or MD5 thing? What is that for? Why don't you use that for a hash table? Well, we don't use them for a hash table because they're designed to have these security properties that for hash tables we don't care about. But these have these other applications that are more notable. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about assembly and machine code. So let's talk about how C++ gets turned into executables briefly. I'm going to give a very high-level overview with scary pictures here. So we have a C++ file, and you know that it turns into a .o file eventually. But there's this intermediate step that you typically don't see. Your compiler generates this file, but just doesn't show it to you. And this is an assembly file. And this is, yes, you know, an excerpt of the actual assembly file for that C file. And yes, there are some like nonsensically scary strings in there. And I've annotated it with what's going on. So we're saying arg1 gets to be the string, arg2 is cout, which for some reason is named underscore capital Z capital ST4 cout. And then we have this call, which is calling the operator and so on. And that gets turned into our .o file, which I think you've seen now because you've done make files that involve producing .o files, so you can compile things separately. And that, when we combine it with our standard library, gets turned into our executable. And in our executable, we have some representation of all these operations. So we turned this C++ code into these, this assembly code, which is low-level operations. So these are things like subtract, move a value, XOR some values. There's a something, some sort of pop. And these get turned into some bytes, which we're going to call machine language. And these bytes represent these instructions, these simple operations, in a one-to-one manner. I've just commented them, but in our executable file, we actually have these bytes, and they typically aren't written in hexadecimal, they're just bytes. I'm showing them in hexadecimal because we can't really just show raw bytes on my slide. So we're going to talk about this process, these two entities. So we have machine language, so that those are the bytes the hardware expects. The hardware, it needs to look for work to do, and it's going to do that by reading some bytes, typically from memory. And it's going to interpret them in some way. And the machine language says, what is the hardware looking for when it's doing that? When it's looking for work to do, what are the bytes it's looking at? What is it going to, how is it going to interpret them? And we also have assembly language, which is our text representation of that. And we're going to go through, start with an example of a toy machine in assembly language, and then after that, we're going to talk about real x86 assembly language, but we're never going to talk about x86 machine language because as you can kind of guess from not being able to see obvious patterns in the bytes I show here, it's kind of complicated in ways which we don't like. You can look it up yourself, I can point you to resources, but we're not gonna actually teach you real machine language, we'll use a toy machine language. And the reason we might care about this, you know, part of it is that if you want to design hardware, obviously you care. If you want to write compilers, well, you kind of need to know what assembly language looks like. But, you know, most of you aren't gonna do that, and we recognize that. But we think it's gonna be helpful because you just want to understand, well, what is my compiler doing? When my compiler doesn't work correctly, what happened? You know, or when my program segfaults, what happened? Knowing assembly language is important to knowing, you know, why, what are the fundamental instructions which can cause a segfault, why is it happening, and give you a better idea of what's going on. And that's the reason we're teaching it. Even though we recognize that some of you might say, I'm never gonna touch this stuff, I'm gonna write all my code in Python and Java, you know, and use compilers other people wrote, and so on. So that's what we'll talk about next time.